You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hello, this is Aisha Hauser in Seattle. Welcome to The View, the Church of the Larger Fellowship show. We are going to introduce our regulars, and then I will introduce our special guest today.
Hi, I'm Meg Riley here in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford here in Austin, Texas.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Shade in Cleveland, Ohio today.
Hey, folks. This is Bob LaValle from the other Rust Belt city, Buffalo, New York.
And today we have Dr. Robin DiAngelo with us. Robin received her PhD in multicultural education from the University of Washington here in Seattle in 2004. She earned her tenure at Westfield State University in 2014. She's taught courses in multicultural teaching, intergroup dialogue facilitation, cultural diversity and social justice, and anti-racist education. Her area of research is in whiteness studies and critical discourse analysis, explicating how whiteness is reproduced in everyday narratives. Robin is a two-time winner of the Students' Choice Award for Educator of the Year, and she's currently serving as a lecturer at the University of Washington, and she is also the Director of Equity for Sound Generations in Seattle, King County. And Robin has been a consultant trainer for over 20 years on issues of race, racial, and social justice. She was appointed to co-design, develop, and deliver the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative and Anti-Racism Training with Darlene Flynn. She's the co-author with Uzlem Sentsoy of Is Everyone Really Equal? An Introduction to Key Concepts in Social Justice Education. And she's the author of What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy. Welcome, Robin. We are very excited to have you. And I'm very happy to call her my friend.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really a thrill to be on. Thank you.
So one of the things I wanted to start with, because you coined the term white fragility. And what's interesting is it has caused a lot of controversy, at least among my white UU friends. So I'd love for you to speak on how you came to coin that term.
It's kind of classic, right? Like I've had people tell me, well, the term itself is offensive, and which is perfect. It's classic white fragility, right? To name whiteness, right, is really problematic for a lot of people. How I came to coin it was I have a really rare job, right? Day in and day out, I hold sustained conversations on race and racism with primarily white audiences. The reason my audiences are primarily white is because I'm in the workplace, and most of the people in those positions are white, right? And in doing that, there were really consistent patterns of engagement. It was almost as if we'd been handed a script, right? And they were so predictable, these reactions. And as I thought about them, they basically looked like fragility to me, the inability to handle any challenge to our positions, our worldview, the entitlement to not have those positions named, right? The entitlement to be seen as, slash demand to be seen as an individual outside of race. And when I use the term fragility, it doesn't mean weak. Right. It really, what it means is I can't handle that, and I will do whatever it takes for you to stop that. And if that means I need to come across as weak, I'll come across as weak. So I'll cry. If it means I need to kind of storm out or get angry and get my back up, I'll do that. And it's not necessarily I'm consciously thinking I'm going to block, but for many factors that I'm sure will emerge as we discuss this deeper. That reflex of, oh, I've got to stop that challenge because it's throwing me off of my racial equilibrium. And racial equilibrium for white folks is, again, comfort around the racial status quo, the default, and that is uncomfortable, so something must be wrong, coupled with, this false idea that to be complicit with racism would make us bad people. You know, there are many threads that lead to this response. So, yeah, I felt the need to just name it and identify it and make it clear And that's one of the things that's important to me in my work, right? I am an academic, and I can write in that really, really high-level academic speak that you can barely understand. But I'm also an educator, and I like to take everyday familiar narratives and responses and then just make it clear, how is this actually functioning in terms of addressing racial inequity?
Robin, can you give examples of white fragility for those who may not be clear on what we're talking about?
Sure. It would be, okay, so the classic example is, if you have a dominant understanding of racism, right, the dominant framework for racism is that it's an either-or proposition, right, that some people are racist and some people are not. And those that are bad people. They're immoral. That's the first thing. Second thing is that racists know they're racist. They actually are openly aware to themselves that they don't like people of color. And so when you give, well, that's the dominant frame, right? An anti-racist frame is there's no way any of us could avoid internalizing the messages of, and I'm going to use the term, you know, I risk right now triggering white fragility in your audience, but white supremacy. We live in and swim in the water of white supremacy. And by that I mean white as central, as superior. And so it is inevitable that I have unaware investments and frameworks and that I'm coming from that place, right? So now you try to give me some feedback about how I just in that moment, right, reinforce that. And I respond very poorly. So the first thing I would ask your audience is, even if they're primarily white, is have you ever noticed any defensiveness on this topic from white people, right? And, you know, even white people laugh at that. Yeah, we know we're really defensive. And I'll often ask people of color, have you ever tried to give white people feedback on our inevitable but often unaware racism and had that go well for you, right? They laugh, right? I look at Aisha. So it's those, why are we so defensive? Why doesn't it go well? Because we hear a moral slight, right? We sincerely believe it wouldn't be possible for us to be racist because we're good people. And so we get very upset and defensive and we cry and we get our feelings hurt and we suggest that you don't know us and you're generalizing and you're just trying to make us feel bad. You've heard all of this, right? I think that's what's resonated so much for people is that it's so familiar. Is that a good example? Is that great?
Yes, and I'm going to have Meg jump in, but I like to tell people that you coined that term for liberals. This was not a term for the people who know they're racist. So, and Meg, sorry, I didn't mean to.
I'm really glad because this is one of, I actually think progressive white folks like me are the hardest. To the degree that we think we're damn, we're good to go, we've got friends of color, we're going to put all our energy into deflecting rather than the ongoing lifelong reflecting that this requires, right? You're never finished. And it comes out in such, well, you know, I'm pausing because from my white point of view, subtle, and maybe more or less subtle to people of color, but it comes out of us in really different kinds of ways, but they're very pernicious, and they create a kind of toxic environment. And so that's another real challenge of this work is getting white progressives to reach for humility on this topic. I have never met a white person without an opinion on racism. Has anybody here ever met anybody? Okay. And yet, sincerely, if you haven't devoted years of sustained study and focus, yeah, you have an opinion. It's misinformed. It's superficial. It's limited. It couldn't be anything other than that because it's so complex and nuanced, and nothing gives us the information we need. You can get a PhD. You can lead a university system without having any skills to engage in this arguably most complex and nuanced social dynamic since the founding of our country, right?
I'm really curious, Robin. Um, uh, would, when you're doing these trainings and you've had the benefit of all this repetition to see the patterns, are there responses that you see when people, when white people get challenged on their white supremacy, that you know are not white fragility? And how do you tell the difference? Does it ever happen?
Oh, yes, of course, it does happen, and I'd certainly like to see, to feel that if I couldn't model it, then, you know, I'm certainly not walking my talk. It doesn't mean feelings don't come up for me. So let me back up. Certainly as a white person in this work, I get consistent feedback from people of color, from other white people. I'm not free of any of this, right? So I step in it all the time. Reinforce things that I'm not aware of reinforcing. And in fact, the reality that I am seen as an expert or having expertise on this topic as a white person reinforces white supremacy, the centrality and authority of the white voice. I'm very clear about that. That's the master's tools dilemma, right? How do you dismantle the master's house when you only have the tools of the master, right? This Audre Lorde's beautiful quote. So yes, it's a both end. At the same time, to not use that platform, if you will, that position to speak truth to power, to challenge, because I can be heard differently. I can be heard by white people in a way, unfortunately, that people of color and the hundreds of people of color behind and beside me that mentored me to the place that I could even articulate this and have been saying these things for a really long time, that they can't be heard. And so I've tossed around that for a long time, trust me. And what I always land on is, well, to not do it is really to be white. And that's not acceptable to me, so I'm gonna do a both end, and I, as much as I'm reinforcing it, I also recognize that I'm challenging it, right? And enough people of color feel affirmed by my work that also keeps me safe. I see a head over there. So, back to your question. What does it look like? Essentially, it looks like receiving the feedback with grace, appreciating the feedback because you sincerely want to identify your patterns and investments, reflecting on the feedback and seeking to change your behavior, checking in with the folks who gave you the feedback, being accountable. It's actually fairly simple. If you have fundamentally integrated an understanding that it's not about being good or bad, right? That it is inevitable, and so can you imagine how this would shift if we actually wanted to see our racism so we could stop it, so we could knock it off? But very few people respond in a way that would convey that they actually care to know. And, you know, and if I may, I'll ask Aisha, I mean, have you had a white person respond well in a way that you wouldn't call white fragility? And what did that look like? Yeah, see, it's hard, right? But
well, very hard, and I think it's why I got so excited after meeting you. And we actually had Robin come to our congregation twice. We could probably have her come 8 more times and still, you know, explore this, because the defensiveness is real. I've actually had a white minister say to me, I had to say things so she can hear them, because she just shut down. And so, that's why your work is so important, because the term white fragility has caught on because of its truth and power.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate it.
Thank you. You know, there's some subtle ways that it manifests for me, because one of the things we don't have skills about either are supporting people who do this work. You know, yes, I do get a lot of affirmations and a lot of accolades, and my goodness, I got a standing ovation at the Aisha's congregation. And I get a lot of critique and a lot of criticism, and I can't get it right for everybody. And so even when I was in your congregation, it looks like silence. I was just in front of a group it was 50 people. It was a work group. There were only 2 people of color in that whole work group. You know, I spent several hours with them laying this out, right, having them reflect. And then whenever I'd ask for, so what are you thinking, what are some insights, how are you connecting this, silence. Then when I, you know, said, I've got to let you know that whether it's intentional or not, you know, whatever each individual reason in this room for being silent, the impact of this is hostile. The people of color in the room aren't sitting here with this room of silent white people on this topic thinking, yeah, this is going well, right? There's a history of harm, and we've got to be willing to show ourselves, right, to take those risks. I often say, people of color already know we're all racist. Okay, come on, we're not, just like, it's, we're not fooling anybody. What they want to see is our willingness to open and show and risk and struggle and make mistakes and repair, right? So I said that to the group, and still the silence remained. It's incredible, the power of it. So that's one way it looks. I'm just simply not going to. Even in this rare opportunity to talk about racism, I'm not going to practice it. And I say to them, I'm not confident you guys are going to be able to go back to your workplace and keep this on the table if you can't even talk about it here in a, you know, in a session that's all set up for you to do it. It also looks like minimization. This is a good introduction. You know, that one always gets me, right? It's like, really? I mean, this is the culmination of my life's work I just presented to you in, you know, in a succinct 3-hour, it's a good start, but I think it's a little more complex than that, right? No, trust me, I've heard it. And so then you say, okay, well, I invite you to add the complexity you see missing, and you'll get something like, oh, it's always some, you didn't acknowledge how unique and different I am from everybody else, right? The very cherished narrative of individualism. And I don't know so much about, I used to actually be a member of a Unitarian congregation, but it's been a while. So I don't know if you reinforce that kind of uniqueness of everyone, but, you know, when it comes to race.
I have a lovely professor in seminary whose favorite saying was, you're special, but you're not unique.
Yeah, there you go. So those narratives of either everyone's special and different and unique, or everyone's the same in the eyes of God. You know, I'm sure on some level, of course, that's true. But you always have to ask yourself, how does that function in a conversation about race? Well, it functions to take it off the table, to take power off the table. It's colorblindness, basically, right? So that's another way it manifests.
And we have a couple questions from our folks. Meg, you want to go first, and then Joanna?
Gosh, I've had like 30 as you've been talking, but I'm
sorry.
So one of them is, you know, it was shocking to me to learn. I mean, I'd been doing anti-racism work for a really long time, because I'm old, before this thing of whiteness really entered the picture, and I realized how in not talking about whiteness, we actually were centering whiteness all the time, right? But that seems kind of ironic that by actually talking about whiteness, you can decenter it because you can put something around it. But would you agree with that, or would you say that differently?
Well, that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, this is a wily beast. Do you know what I mean? And it just is that both end again. Yes, we have got to put the spotlight on whiteness, right? That's that missing piece of, you know, let's study them. It, you know, it's the unnamed kind of backdrop for all of it and water. And it's also can be really narcissistic and much more interesting than hearing the narratives of people of color, right? It can also, you know, that's in there.
That's the tricky part, right, for me. I mean, as I wake up, I'm just seeing, like, you know, 100 times a day, like, damn, I did it again. Oh, I did it again. And but that's because I'm waking up, because it's not like I'm suddenly doing it. It's like I can see something I've done forever. And so one of the things that really surprised me is Heather Hackman is a local person here who works in this area, who I've worked with some on whiteness. And she says that for white people a lot, we don't actually come to a sense of racial identity until we're adults, whereas most people of color come to that much, you know, age 5 or something. And generally, like for me, when I was really reflecting on it, it was when I interned in a church where I was in the minority and my culture didn't work anymore that I suddenly went, I have a culture and it's not working. Gosh, I thought it was universal. What a surprise.
Yeah.
What do you say about that?
One of the things I try to help white people get in touch with is how deeply and how from the moment we're born, and quite honestly, even where we could be born, how we're born, what our parents have access to, how we're treated, who owned the hospital we're born in, who took the trash out. I mean, seriously, we are born into a racial hierarchy. And that while we don't have an aware racial identity, we definitely do. You know, and so this, just, you know, all of this stuff is tricky, but I want to push back on a narrative of racial innocence, right? Like somehow we're not aware.
I wouldn't say
I might not have been able to tell you, but I always knew it's better to be white. Every child knows it's better to be white by age 3 or 4, right? There's a reflection exercise I do in my workshops, and one of them is, what are some of the ways in which your race has shaped your life? And a really common pattern is for white people to begin that, answering that question by the first time they interacted across race, right? Because we don't have a sense that a racially segregated space is an active space. It is a racially active space. That race isn't out missing from it. And in fact, it's the result of decades of policies and practices that created it as segregated and maintain it as segregated, even in the present time, right? And every moment we're in it, we're getting the most profound message of all, which is there's no inherent value in the lives or perspectives or relationships with people of color. So I know what Heather means, and I also really want people to go to that deep, deep stuff, if you will.
Well, exactly. That's, I guess, what I'm tangled up in, because it is like both and they can. It's sort of like Buddhism as near enemies, you know. So
yeah, I don't know that one.
something can look sort of like something else, but it's not. It's really different. And white innocence, the projection that whites are innocent, is really different from acknowledging how ignorant we are.
Right. And, you know, it's a willful ignorance. It's an aggressive ignorance.
Sure.
Something we work at not seeing, and that's where white fragility comes in. And again, we're taught to do that because we get punished when we want to see it. We get, it's miserable. This is why, how many white people just say, Uncle Bob just said that thing at the table, I'm just not going to go there. It's too hard. It's miserable. The whole dinner's going to be ruined. Those things kind of keep us ignorant, but it's an active kind of ignorance, right? Yeah.
Joanna, jump in.
Yeah, so I study systems theory, and one of the core ideas in this is that we feel anxiety, and then we try to get some sort of closure to relieve that feeling, you know, either by running away or going into the conflict. What is the role of, I guess, being comfortable with discomfort and a lack of closure, and what is that, you know, I've heard the term sitting in discomfort. What does that look like?
Well, one, it's, I do believe it's fundamental. I do not believe we can get there in comfort. So if we think about it as the default of our society, our school system, our institutions, our media, is the reproduction of white supremacy. I'm just going to say it. That's the default, and that's become comfortable for us, right? I mean, as we were just saying, you can walk through the day without ever thinking about any of this, right? So I do believe we have to get out of our racial comfort. Now, of course, there's a difference between discomfort and panic, and, you know, I would hope that panic would get worked through, because I also don't want it to be the reason I can't do this, right? Because then it's functioning as, again, closure and protection. But nonetheless, yes, you have to actually embrace and be excited that you're uncomfortable, because I think we can look at other aspects of our lives. My deepest learning and basically every life lesson came because it was really hard, right? It doesn't come when I'm on my game and comfortable. Then I'm complacent. Definitely. And that discomfort will include threads of guilt, threads of shame, unfortunately. I mean, I wish it didn't, but that it's going to trigger early shame. Embarrassment, boy, who wants to feel those things? But I just
one of the things One of the things I loved that you brought up, or that came up at both the workshops, is the difference between safety and discomfort, and people saying, oh, I don't feel safe. And I love when you said, I've done this for 25 years. No one's ever punched anyone else in one of these workshops. And I think, because in UU circles, there's a lot of, I need to feel safe. And I've had people say it to me. And that's, I think, something that would be interesting for you to speak to, the difference between safety and discomfort.
Thank you so much for handing me that. I would love to. I do discourse analysis. So you look at language is very powerful. It shapes reality. Language is not an objective, clear, you know, these are just neutral words for some kind of objective reality. The language we have in itself kind of shapes reality, right? And the word safe is very powerful in many ways. At a very deep level, I think it invokes, I am innocent and there's something dangerous here. It reinscribes really deep narratives that racialized others are inherently dangerous and unsafe, and now we're going to kind of get in conversation about that, right? Again, that's at a deeper level, but when you're talking about a cross-racial discussion and you start using words like safe, and you live in a society that relentlessly positions black and brown people as unsafe and their spaces as unsafe, on some level that's invoked, right, on a deep level. It's also a really cherished discourse that everybody backs off when you invoke it, right? So personal experience is the same thing. Oh, that's just my personal experience. Well, as soon as I say that, I mean, what can you do? You can't know my personal experience. And the ideology is that it's wrong to question somebody's personal experience, right? And that also rests on the assumption that experience is somehow closed or unique or asocial, ahistorical, apolitical, right? So again, of course we all have experiences that we may not know, but how does it function? And the way I've seen it function is to block the challenge from going any further. So you start challenging me, Aisha, and as soon as I go to, well, okay, I hear you, but that's just my personal experience. I was taught to see everybody equal. You can't keep going with me now, right? So safety is really similar. Oh my goodness, that's so cherished. Everybody must feel safe, that word, right? But I like to ask white people, what does it mean to need to feel safe from a position of social, historical, cultural, institutional power and privilege? What does that mean? No, you're perfectly safe. What you really mean is you don't feel comfortable. But that's not as cherished. That's harder to get away with, right? I need to feel comfortable in that dialogue. Well, you know. It's similar. Look, gender, I access gender a lot to understand racism because I also am super frustrated by patriarchy. We live in a patriarchal society. And when I don't understand a piece of racism, I will ask I'll kind of go, okay, imagine a man just said to you in a dialogue about sexism what you're saying right now. Oh, got it. So I'm in a room full of men, 50 men, 3 women, and someone's coming in to talk about sexism. And the men say, oh, we don't feel safe talking about sexism. I mean, I would find that just ludicrous and outrageous and like, you're kidding me, right? Right. And so then I'm like, aha, I get it, right? And if for the men in the room, for the white men in the room, you know, anywhere if you can, and honestly it's harder, but if you can access some place where you feel less than, so you're a faculty member and you're in front of all the deans, provosts, and presidents of the university trying to talk to them about how their policies and practices affect your ability to work, something where you're acutely aware that there's a status and power difference, and they start invoking not feeling safe to talk to you about it, right? You'll get it then. So yeah, I wish we would drop that word. The last thing I want to say about it, and I do because I use my language and my words really deliberately. I think it perverts the true direction of a historical violence to say, I don't feel safe merely talking about racism. It distorts genocide, enslavement, hundreds and hundreds of years of enslavement, torture, medical experimentation, imprisonment, etc. So, there you go. I'll stop there.
You're talking about gender. I had wondered, went back in the beginning when you were saying there are really predictable ways that the conversations go. If they're predictable with white men versus white women, if you see gender differences in the way that white fragility manifests.
Yeah, thanks for that question, too. I'm loving all of your questions. Definitely, right? One of the things when I'm wanting people to grapple with intersectionality, right, I'm not just white, I'm also female, I'm also able-bodied, etc., right, is to ask yourself, how do my other identities and the way I was socialized into them set me up to collude with racism, right? And of course, gender socialization is different across gender assignment. What I see more from men is intellectualization, either definitely silence, which is very powerful for everyone else in the room. You know, you got just a couple of white men, which is often the case. If it's voluntary, you're not going to get a lot of white men. That's the truth, right? That's the reality. There are going to be less men in it. Or if you're in the workplace and you're looking at the high, you're dealing with the top, you're going to get more white men. But their silence is really, it's scary. I find it a little scary because I don't know where they're coming from. And whether they are meaning it to or not, it starts to control the room, right? It can also manifest in taking up a lot of space. But recently, two days ago, I was at the University of Eugene. Gave a keynote, so I just kind of laid this thing out, and a white man raised his hand, and he said, yeah, I think it's a little more complex than that. I think this is very simplistic, and I just said, you just reduced my life's work to, you raised your hand, I can't even imagine, to a speaker, just raising your hand and completely dismissing. I did say something. I must admit. I said, that's kind of classic from you as a white male to reduce my life's work to simplistic. And he kept talking over me, so he didn't hear me, I don't think. But what his point was that he thought I was being simplistic about was I wasn't addressing why there are so many Asian students at UC Berkeley. It's that arrogance, right? It's that reduction and dismissal and that he felt so confident and entitled to dismiss my work when if that's what he's going to invoke, he probably hasn't thought very deeply about the topic. But that doesn't really matter.
It feels like this might be a good time to bring up Trump and the Trump effect. And I say to people, I think we should be ready that he might be president. And I literally have people like, that is never going to happen. I said, we were saying he would never win the GOP nomination. So there is something scary and sinister happening, but it's also, I'd love to hear your take on, reflections on what's happening, but how we can realistically fight it, frankly, or what you think the counter is.
So I have two thoughts. One, of course, is the white fragility. It's a more explicit white fragility, right? It's from folks who either right on the top or just below the surface feel like they're losing their place. The good old days are the days when essentially white men were in charge of everything, and that wasn't questioned. The good old days are also, even when white working class men had really good steady jobs and they could hold out other people, right, women, people of color, and this, and I would say false sense, if you will, that of who's threatening that, right, and this, like, I'm entitled to say whatever I want, whenever I want, and now I don't get to make jokes, and I don't get to, so now, that bitter resentment about, I should have to think about what I say before I say it. I don't get to just, say whatever I want. I mean, so it ranges from some really deep, like, important issues like income to, I would say, more trivial, like, I want to be able to say whatever I want, whenever I want, make fun of whoever I want, and not have any accountability to it, right? So I think that it's very, very, very triggered. It's making people irrational, which is what white fragility does. We get irrational. You know, there's a long history of dog whistle politics, right? Blaming, you know, looking down and blaming the less powerful for what is clearly happening from the top. He just, like, galvanized all of that, right? And I want to be careful with progressives around Trump because it's really easy to use him to reinforce the good white, bad white, and to see ourselves as outside of that, and it's those conservatives, and I mean, he is so classically, I have this slide where I have the, here's the racist, here's the not racist, and he just fits the classic archetype, right, of the white racist. But that's a really problematic binary because it removes me from it, and it also, it doesn't have me looking at how I'm complicit, that he can't do that without the silence of the masses, if you will. So that kind of leads to what to do about it, and that's a much harder question. I'm just gonna, I'm with you, like, I'm nervous, very nervous. So I will leave that to the activists for now.
You know, people do change, and there's been a lot of change in a lot of people's attitudes over the last, you know, 20, 30, 50 years. And so looking at this Trump thing and this kind of, I mean, basically you're looking at a panic reaction to the challenge to white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Just reflecting on, you know, in my own self, like, how... it's really hard to identify exactly what it is that moved me along, right, in it. You know, I mean, it's like kind of, we're in a process here where we're trying to calm down tens of millions of panicking people who are being reinforced in their panic by what appears to be political success. I mean, yeah. I'm sure that for the folks at the Trump rally, it's a very affirming experience that affirms their panic. And it encourages it, you know. It's like, so, how do you calm that down? I don't know.
Yeah, no, and I don't either.
I try to think about myself because I went through years of being panicky about this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know.
So a lot of it.
Go ahead.
You gave me the opportunity to pull one piece out of what you said that I'd like to speak to the, again, the progressives in the audience that aren't going to relate to Trump, right? And it's the idea of we've made progress, right, in attitudes. And, of course, we have, and yet, racial disparity hasn't changed, right? So I think that the kind of sense of progress and attitudes actually functions to have us feel okay about our own roles and then not actually addressing or challenging any of it, right? So I think recognizing racism or white privilege, right? More and more white people can even use the language, which is a big breakthrough, right? They can use the language, but awareness without action is really meaningless, and in some ways a little more pernicious. I would imagine Aisha could speak to that, right? So are we putting it on the table in our organizations, keeping it on the table, looking at our policies and practices, asking ourselves who's here, who isn't, how do we know, who are we accountable to, how are our decisions going to impact people of color? What about our environment is welcoming to white people? What is not? All of those, like in our own institutions and around us, those are really hard conversations to keep on the table. And so that piece, in a way, the sense of increased awareness has gotten us more complacent, I think. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I have a related.
It does to us. It does.
Okay.
It does, but there's, you know, the question of, you know, once you move to Trump and the level of political power that's involved in that, which is different than looking at the political power inside of organizations, where changing attitudes should have had more of an effect if they were more
concrete, actually
rooted. And they should have had more. The difference between like struggling around racism in the UUA versus struggling around racism in the USA, there's a huge power component involved in that. How much power does it take to move the system? So all I'm trying to say is, and I don't want to, just trying to reflect on some lessons that we may have learned so far that could be useful in thinking about this mass phenomena right now in a political sphere of white panic. That's, there has to be something has happened in the last 50 years that can give us a building block or a lesson about how we move forward.
Yeah, I think if we had truly integrated, and I even want to be careful with integration and inclusion are not the same thing, right? So a lot of the focus is just on getting more people of color, but the water is not addressed, right? And so those environments often remain kind of toxic to people of color, right? So truly integrating and changing our institutions, you would have, if you could do that, you would also be much more skilled at keeping and pushing against these kinds of political movements, right? But we're kind of shell-shocked, and we don't even have the basic skills in our kind of local environments, much less how to translate that to the larger, kind of larger society.
I think if I could jump in, one of the things that I've noticed that frustrates me, and you've heard me say this, Robin, in Unitarian Universalism, is how Unitarian Universalism replicates the dominant culture in a startling way. And one of the things I've said is the two congregations that we hold up, we being the Unitarian Universalist Association, as crazy integrated, multicultural, and I think the most is maybe 20-25% people of color, the senior ministers are still white men. And so they're lovely white men. It's not about them as personally, but it's hard for me to fully appreciate the diversity and inclusion in Unitarian Universalism will always be an aspiration until we have more folks in power who are not white. And so part of the change, when people, start looking down on Trump supporters or Trump, I say we create, Trump is a collective result, consequence. Democrats don't get a pass, liberals don't get a pass, Unitarian Universalists don't get a pass. Mm-hmm. So let's not feel too good about ourselves, and we need to work towards something. So Meg, you could jump in there. Oh, we have a viewer question. Have you read Connor Friedersdorf's article last year in The Atlantic titled Police Brutality and the Role That Whiteness Plays? Did that article influence your thinking moving forward? I'm not familiar with the article. Have you read it?
I haven't either, but I'll look it up. But before I forget, you said something I wanted to speak to. Yeah, I think one of the ways that whites are socialized is not to see ourselves as having a white worldview, right? Not to see ourselves as white at all, and not to recognize how profoundly and deeply we do have a white worldview, right? And so when we're leading, we can be good folks, but we will necessarily replicate that white kind of approach for your reference. And so I that's why to get more people to start to challenge that and introduce other worldviews, but also the skills to, how do I say this, to hear them, right? Because often what happens, in the beginning, you have just a few people of color, right? You're working on it, right? You're working on opening up. But there's such a deep message in the lives that we lead as white people that there really isn't any inherent value in people of color's perspectives, right? We certainly aren't shown that in so many different ways. And so when you do have somebody like the one person on a committee and they have a different way of seeing things, or an alternative, it often gets dismissed, quite frankly, right? And then eventually they're seen as problematic, right? Unless they kind of keep the white folks comfortable. And because there's only one or two, it's so hard to push against that. And so we also have to, you know, as we, you know, I don't know, was there expression, build as we climb or something like that, right? Like as we get there, we also have to be able to build the capacity to take in those points of views and those challenges. Yeah. So many people of color will say, oh, I have friends who just won't be on those committees anymore. I'm tired of being tapped to be a token when you don't really want my perspective, when, you know, if as long as I agree with the rest of the committee, it's going to go okay, and you're not even compensating me for all that extra labor. You're putting this psychic burden of race on me, not on yourselves. Right? There's all these dynamics that happen that have to be addressed too.
So Joanna has a question, and then Bob. So Joanna,
with all of the conversations you've had with so many people, have you found anything that helps people have a breakthrough about this idea of this false idea of whiteness being neutral, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think Aisha got to see me demonstrate that. I work really hard to make the water visible and undeniable. It's just not deniable. And I do it using everyday images that surround us that, again, are recognizable. And I just, one after another, after another, after another, with also the narrative to go with it. And when I'm done, it's like, you can't deny it. Or it certainly is harder. And that seems to really...
What do you mean by images? So, like what?
Oh, I actually use images from advertising, from schools, media, images of God, right? Images of the universal human, Adam and Eve, right? All these images, all the covers, right? The current cover of People magazine, World's Most Beautiful Woman 2016 is Jennifer Aniston, right? Just as much of that as I can to kind of support the claim that I open with, which is no one misses the message, it's better to be white. I didn't miss it, you didn't miss it, no child misses it. But of course, the impact is different depending on our relationship to it. And that does really seem to have people, that and having them look at their neighborhoods, and again, that... Most white people think if they grew up in segregation, they don't really know anything about race. And I try to get them to see how much that shaped them and their teaching force and how much that shaped them and their schools. And it does seem to work. I mean, Aisha, you might have gotten feedback from people that had big ahas.
Huge ahas, and I'm going to give a pitch right now. RobinDiAngelo.com. Bring Rob into your congregation. Six congregations in the Puget Sound area came together, and you presented a 4-hour workshop. I understand you're going to a UU church on the East Coast. I cannot recommend enough. And if I had a wish for Unitarian Universalism, you would visit all of our 1,000 member congregations and give your workshop.
Thank you.
It is that powerful.
And do the Ware lecture.
Yes, the Ware lecture.
I see. I'm looking at the question. It's kind of cool to look. How about you?
Bob, you want to jump in? You have a question?
I have a question, if you don't mind.
Bob LaValle has a question.
Meg and I are both involved in our local chapters of showing up for racial justice. One of the core values is this idea of calling people in versus calling them out, and the idea being that shame is a poor posture for changing people's minds. And I'm wondering what advice you have for folks doing that kind of work about how to walk the line between holding white people accountable and not having them completely shut down and end the conversation.
You guys ask the best questions. You two, I'm so happy I get an opportunity to speak to that.
Well, also, if you have any thoughts about the Surge model in general, I'm sure you're familiar with it. That'd be great.
So that question, I recently was at the White Privilege Conference. I did a workshop on white fragility, and then the very first question was a white psychologist asking, how do you, you know, not have white people feel shame? And I think there's a reason that was the first question. It's a hard one because, of course, shame is icky, and I wish we weren't deeply implanted in us. And yet, that trying to avoid it ends up having us coddling white people's emotions and feelings and kind of bending over backwards not to have anybody feel that. And I actually just don't think you can avoid it, unfortunately. I think the more you understand racism as a system that's inevitable, that you didn't choose, but that you have to take responsibility for and wake up to, the less shame you're going to feel, the less guilt. I often point to myself and say, I mean, I hope I'm coming across as a pretty empowered person, because I am, and yet I'm clear I am completely saturated in this and will be for the rest of my life. It's so liberating and transformative. And so some ways you can think of the shame as that first block, again, that functions to stop the way out is through, right? You have to get through it, past it, and there's something on the other side. And I do worry about how it sets up, and I'll just say it directly, a lot of coddling that I don't honestly have a lot of patience for. Even like these common guidelines, you go to a workshop and there's the, you know, obligatory set of ground rules, they're posted as if they're universally going to create a space that's constructive for everybody, but they're really guidelines to keep white people comfortable, and that are never interrogated, and that don't account for power. So things like assume good intentions. No, focus on impact. Your intentions, yeah, of course, I will start from the premise that you have good intentions, although honestly, I find that irrelevant. I want to know what my impact was. Another one is, I'm actually working on it. I know that I'm a little controversial and provocative, okay? So, and I think that's important. I'm working on a piece on trust, right? Because this is another one. You've got to build trust, right? And in trying to figure out what do white people mean when they say that, right? When that's so important to them, frankly, because again, no one's ever stolen a wallet or anything. What I have found that they mean is I need to trust that you don't think I'm racist before I can work on my racism. I need to trust that you won't judge me as, you won't judge me, and usually that is you won't judge me as being racist. Well, first of all, that's not humanly possible to not judge. That's another one you get. Don't judge. Don't make assumptions. The nature of an assumption is you don't know you're making it. That putting that on the list will not stop me from making my assumptions, okay? How about be willing to examine your assumptions if they're pointed out to you, right? Anyway, where was I? Don't you stop me. I'm on a roll. I really want to make this point.
Well, I'm curious about
I love this stuff.
Good. What about Surge?
Another one is speak your truth. This is a popular one that came out of Glenn Singleton's Courageous Conversations, and I see this on so many lists, and I'm like, speak your truth. What if my truth is that I'm colorblind? That's my truth. I am colorblind. I don't even notice Asia's not white. I'm sorry. That's actually not a truth. It's not. No humans are colorblind, so you're wrong. I'm not going to like hold the space where misinformation can be affirmed. We're here to challenge racism. And integral to racism is misinformation, right? That's one too. Like, well, let's affirm where everyone's at, you know, like everyone's perspective. I'm sorry, some are wrong. If I was in an astronomy class and I insisted that a black hole was a dead moon, the instructor would say, oh no, you're wrong. And if I put that on my exam, I'd be wrong, right? It's like it's okay to just say, I'm sorry, but that's misinformed and problematic because it's doing this. I'd like to believe people want to learn how racism works and their role in it when they go to a workshop. So these guidelines also don't account for power. This be respectful. Well, honestly, for people of color, respect is getting uncomfortable, getting real, naming. And for white people, respect is don't make me uncomfortable, don't make me feel bad. I see so much coddling. And, I was going to this piece I'm writing on trust. honestly, the only thing I need to trust from a facilitator is you got a kick-ass analysis of racism, and you will hold me accountable for mine. That's what I want from you. And how you do it, it would be great if you didn't point your finger and shout to me that I'm a racist. That I'd probably be able to hear it a little bit better if you didn't do it that way. But if you do it that way, that's on you. You're being a jerk. What's on me is to try to separate the messenger from the message. Is there some really kernel of important truth that I need to look at? And I know that's the opposite, because so many people are like, don't do the gotcha, and you know all of that. And do you all notice how much emphasis is on is do this gently, do this respectfully, don't make people feel bad, don't make people... And I've seen people give the most diplomatic feedback possible, and people still feel completely upset by it. That's white fragility. And that's why I wrote a piece called The Rules of Engagement, and the cardinal rule for giving white people feedback on our inevitable racism appears to be don't give it to us at all. I mean, that seems to be the only way to get it right. But if you must, here's all the ways you have to do it. So back to shame. Of course, I don't want to mire someone in it, but I think that's part of our personal work, and I can't be so careful about it that I fundamentally am not naming racism. And the mere naming of racism will trigger shame for white people until we can get past the good-bad binary.
Amen, Robin. We have a few minutes left, and is there something that we didn't ask that you would like to address? This has been one of my favorite shows ever, if I could just say. So, yes. So, is there something we haven't asked, or maybe something, a thought in your head you'd like to share in our last few minutes?
Because I know you've got a lot of, like, well-meaning white folks out there. Just please, 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 no matter where you're at, always know there's more you can go. Don't ever, ever say, I already know this. I would never say that. I will go to every workshop I can on this. Obviously, I know this. I teach this. I write about this. But I will always go to gain more insight. Oh, I love the way they put that. Oh, you know, so don't be complacent, and don't call yourself an ally or an anti-racist. So I'll back up and say, I've committed my work to anti-racist work and education, right? But I don't call myself an ally, and I don't call myself an anti-racist, because that is for people of color to decide if in any given moment I'm behaving in anti-racist ways. I am the least qualified to make that determination, especially given how much of this is implicit and unconscious and how deeply invested I am in it. How could I not be, right? I've committed my life to challenging those investments, but they're there. So that reminds me to be accountable. It reminds me that I'm never finished, that in this moment, how am I doing? You know, and to always be thinking strategically and consciously, and to resist complacency. So I would end with that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been an amazing show. Next week, the Black Lives of You, you will be on The View. And any last words from any of our panel?
Thank you, thank you, thank you for your work.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks. Thanks.
Tremendous.
Thank you. Thank you all. See you next week on The View.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.